From the land of Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 17th day of March, 2022. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett. He's at agmarket.net. I'll update you on the agricultural news and the weather forecast for the day. And Lance Honig, chief of the crops branch from USDA NASS, will be here to discuss how the survey is captured for the upcoming prospective plantings report. That's due out next week from the United States Department of Agriculture. And he'll also tell us about a brand new function that will come up after that report is released. The Secretary's briefing will be viewable live on YouTube. We'll tell you how to watch it right here on this edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
May corn for the day at $7.54.5, up 24.5 cents. July 7, 18.75, 21.75 higher. December at $6.45, up 15.25. And the May contract at $16.68.5. And the soybeans, 19.25 cents higher. July futures there, up 21.25 at $16.47.25. And November new crop at $14.69.25. Up 9 on the afternoon. Bean meal down $3.90. Bean oil $1.08 higher. Wheat futures up 28.75 in the lead May at 10.98 for the soft red. July the harvest month up 33.5 at 10.76, and the July hard red at $10.83.25, up 24.75 cents. Live cattle futures at $135.92.5, 40 cents higher. Feeders were down $1.40 at $165.87.5 for 100 pounds. And lean hogs at $116.97.5, down $3.50. Crude oil at $102.80 a barrel, up $7.60. And gasoline, 21.7 cents higher, $3.16.9 of a cent. Matt Bennett from agmarket.net now joins us to discuss the trade in Chicago. Hi, Matt. Thank you for being with us. Markets were higher again today. What's driving them?
You know, yesterday was more of a kind of a risk-off event due to talk that Russia and Ukraine were having ceasefire negotiations and talking about ways that they can maybe tone down, you know, some of the fears, I guess, that everyone has had as far as what export situations might look like, planting, you name it. Today, you know, you come in and there's a lot of talk about an address that Putin had overnight where he said that he still wants to see Ukraine cleansed of, you know, some of the Western influences. And I mean, the talk didn't sound overly ceasefire type by any stretch of the imagination. So it's more of another, I guess, realization that this thing isn't probably going to come to an end anytime soon. You know, and there's a lot of talk about plantings in Ukraine, and most people are calling for the crop. What I've seen is with the corn crop being, you know, maybe 2/3 of what we saw this past year. So there's definitely a lot of concerns as to what that looks like for not only this year's export market, but next year's export market as well.
Given all of that, what should a producer here in the United States think about it, and how do they deploy a marketing strategy to manage the risk that comes with all the volatility in this marketplace?
You know, I think one thing you got to remember, Todd, is spring insurance price, of course, that, you know, we just were able to get it finalized last week on Monday, you know, and basically it's been 10 days ago now, but 15 days ago. Regardless, it's one of those deals, though, where we're 53-54 cents above that already here in mid-March. So as a producer, how do you look at that? Well, I know a lot of what I've looked at in the past, whenever it comes to crop insurance, if you're very much above the insurance price, we need to at least be looking at locking in, you know, some worst case scenarios on at least the uninsured bushels. And so I know people look at the market whenever it's over $6 and think, oh, 55 cents isn't all that much. But we got to remember what 55 cents seemed like a couple of years ago. And it still adds up to a lot of money. It's over $100 an acre for most producers here in Central Illinois. So I'm a big advocate of at least layering in a put option here and there as the market rallies. I'm not so sure that the market's going to be done anytime soon, especially given the war situation. But at the same time, these corn at 644 and no beans at almost 1470, those are price levels most years we dreamt of. And so we didn't get those prices because we had an off crop. We got them because of other events in the world. And we need to remember that and be willing to step in and protect those.
So you're at hopefully 15, 20, or 25% sales, depending on where you are related to crop insurance. And that's the kind of protection you're talking about?
Yeah. And so overall, including sales, hedges of risk, if you will, floors, we've got about 30% of the corn crop protected in some way or another. We do have floors on beans, you know, all the way up to about 50%. And so we've only got about 20% of physical sales. I've been saying all along, I don't want to be locked into physical sales on too large of a percentage this year, given the kind of volatility that we expect. You know, we could see wildly higher prices if we have issues with production. Now, some of these forecasters right now are talking about a pretty decent, they call it a drought buster coming up through Texas into Kansas, Missouri and Illinois. I think it would probably be a very advantageous rain for a large part of the area that really sticks out as far as the National Drought Monitor goes. If that happens, you've got to think a little bit of risk premium is actually already in the market. I don't think it's much personally, but I do think that it would kind of ease the minds of some traders as they move forward into this growing season, because we all know that sometimes when you start a season super dry, it's really tough to break out of that.
Are you more worried about protecting the price of corn from downside risk or the price of soybean at this point for new crop?
That's a really good question. My personal feeling is that with $14.70 soybeans, you know, we raced all the way to $15.50 at one point. You know, I've got to think there's a decent amount of downside risk if we end up with very robust bean acres. Now, some people are calling for bean acreage to be in excess of corn acreage. I don't know that we'll see that on the planting intentions report, but if we don't get a good spring, I think those acreage numbers could be awfully close. And so, you know, if you would have a really good growing season, there's no doubt you could see this carryout level get a little bit more, in my opinion, relatively speaking, a little bit looser, I guess, than what you would see maybe over on the corn side of things. So I at least want to have a floor under myself and protect, you know, some of these price levels we've seen. I think with corn, it's a little more complicated. My thought process is that protecting a $6 type price level, especially with a $5.90 spring price, makes a heck of a lot of sense. I just think we've got a little bit of time yet, because I think the trade is kind of waiting around to see what these acreage estimates look like and what kind of a spring planting window we have. And I think if we have any issues whatsoever, we could expect another leg higher on this corn market.
I know you've probably been asked by end users, cattle producers in particular, about booking some of their needs and what they should do. How should livestock folks deal with these high markets?
Yeah, we've been talking to them for the last several months about getting a fair amount of protection for themselves, just due to what we saw as a tightening global balance sheet, U.S. for sure. I think that if you're an end user, you've got to tip your cap and understand what's going on at the Gulf right now. CIF values have been awfully strong, but we've seen really good export, you know, export numbers were again good this today, over 1.8 million. You know, you're looking at really good loadouts, though. The schedule moving forward is pretty darn strong, you know, and as a producer that's looking to buy corn, you got to understand what kind of demand you're going to be dealing with. So, you know, what can they do in particular? I think that not booking their needs as they get them, I don't think that that's a great idea. At the very least, we've had producers get in a situation where they're, you know, buying some call coverage just in case this market gets wildly out of hand to the upside. I certainly wouldn't want to leave too much of that pricing open, especially if I'm on the buy side of things.
Hey, thank you.
Absolutely, Todd. Thank you.
That's Matt Bennett. He is with AgMarket.net and will join us for our Commodity Week program. We'll record that Friday. In today's agricultural news, the Biden administration remains noncommittal on renewing summertime E15 sales while continuing to push full-scale use of electric vehicles in the federal fleet. The press corps asked White House spokesperson Jen Psaki about the sales.
A bipartisan group of lawmakers have called on the White House to lift the ban of summer sales of gasoline with higher blends of ethanol. Mm-hmm. It's cheaper than traditional blends of gasoline. Is that something you mentioned, a menu of options, but is that something specifically that the White House is considering?
To which Jen Psaki, the White House spokesperson, responded,
"In the menu of options."
That is, the White House puts pressure on the independent U.S. Postal Service to reverse its decision to replace more than 12,000 mail delivery vehicles with gas-powered, not electric ones. Ethanol state lawmakers like Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley are protesting.
President Biden and his allies in Congress should rethink a one-size-fits-all electric vehicle mandate. Instead, they should support an all-of-the-above approach that takes advantage of biofuels.
Grassley joined other Midwest senators in a letter to Biden urging the president to stop pressuring the Postal Service. With gas prices recently averaging over $4.30 a gallon, the lawmakers introduced legislation to make year-round E15 sales permanent and provide a tax credit for higher blends. And here's one other news item from Washington, D.C. The EPA has further restricted over-the-top dicamba use in Minnesota and Iowa. The Environmental Protection Agency this week announced further label restrictions on over-the-top use of dicamba in those two states. The changes requested by pesticide registrants in consultation with those states are intended to reduce risk from the use of over-the-top dicamba, an herbicide used to control certain types of broadleaf weeds. The revised labeling prohibits over-the-top dicamba application on dicamba-tolerant crops after June 20th in Iowa and on dicamba-tolerant crops south of Interstate 94 after June 12 in Minnesota. The cutoff date for land north of Interstate 94 remains June 30. The revisions also prohibit the practice when the air temperature is over 85 degrees at the time of application, or if the forecasted high temperature of the nearest available location exceeds 85 degrees in Minnesota. These restrictions are intended to reduce the likelihood of volatility and off-site movement of over-the-top dicamba by avoiding application on days with high temperatures, according to the EPA. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, Lance Honig, Chief of the Crops Branch at USDA NAS, the National Agricultural Statistics Service, now joins us to discuss the upcoming report, the prospective plantings numbers that are due out at the end of the month. Thank you, Lance, for taking some time with us. This is a survey of producers across the United States, and it really looks at all the crops that NAS tracks. Can you tell me about it?
Sure, and it is. It's, you know, the first look at what farmers intend to plant the upcoming season. As you said, it's based on a survey of farmers, usually around 75,000 or so farmers. We collect the data roughly the first 2 weeks of March. And so you can tell right off the bat, right, that this is information we're gathering before farmers really even get in the fields in most places. And so they truly are intentions. But as you look ahead to the upcoming season, you want to put some numbers around what acreage is going to look like by crop this season. The farmers are the only people that really know what they're thinking. And so that's why we get out ahead of it. We survey those producers. We ask them, what are you planning at the time that we talk to you now?
Is there anything that USDA NAS does with that number to massage it in any way?
Well, so what we do is, you know, we take all those responses. We summarize that up, of course. But we do compare it with, you know, previous years, how do intentions compare to what's actually planted? So our goal, of course, is to estimate how many acres are going to be planted to each crop, you know, in total this year. It's based on intentions today. And so there's a couple of things that go on with this data. Number one, things change, right? I mean, you're talking about asking intentions, you know, several weeks before planters even get in the fields. And so some things can change. The weather can change. The economics can change. And so therefore, farmers' plans can change. And so some of that happens, and there's some noise in the data that way. But on top of that, there's also always some natural bias between the data you collect and what the estimates end up at the end of the season. And so that's the part that we have to filter out and adjust in the estimates that we publish in the report at the end of the month.
Can you offer an example of what the natural bias looks like?
Well, so, you know, if we just talk in general terms, and this really isn't specific to this report or even acreage for that matter, there's certain tendencies that people have when they report information. And so farmers are no different than anybody else. They've got some natural tendencies to either, you know, report in one direction or the other compared to reality. Yield's probably the greatest example. The truth of the matter is that farmers tend to underreport their yields a little bit as they're forecasting throughout the season. And you get to the end and you find out what that is. And so those sort of things happen across all the information that we gather. And we need to filter that out and translate it to what we believe is going to be the actual answers at the end of the day.
When the trade looks at the acreage figures for corn and soybeans, they'll wonder about an item that is included, I'm almost positive, in those two numbers, which is prevent plant. Can you tell me how it's incorporated?
So prevent plant is not included in the prospective plantings. It's not included in any of our acreage numbers because prevent plant, by definition, is not planted. And so therefore, these estimates that represent total acres planted for each crop would not naturally include prevent plant because it's not planted. Now, with that said, this early in the season, the expectation would be that you're not going to have prevent plant. And so it is certainly possible that there could be acres included in the prospective plantings report that ultimately become prevent plant and therefore get backed out when we get ahead to June acreage and find out that they were not indeed planted. So technically, we don't include prevent plant. But you're probably not going to know if it's prevent plant already in March.
Well, my understanding was that that was one of the things that USDA massaged into the numbers, knowing that there would be some form of prevent plant in the acreage from the United States, and so it would adjust total prospective plantings down some to account for that.
So not specifically. And so again, when I talk about, you know, comparing what we collect in March with what the final acreage is at the end of the season, you know, there are some differences that occur in that information historically. And if some of that happens to be prevent plant, then yes, it would get accounted for that way. But we do not specifically make any adjustments just for prevent plant.
I stand corrected in that case. One other item is there will be a brand new, along with the prospective plantings report, piece of information that producers can watch on YouTube, the live briefing to the secretary or whoever happens to be taking the report from the United States Department of Agriculture. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, that's right. And we're pretty excited about that. Obviously, for many, many years, when these reports are released, we have provided a briefing to the secretary, both here at NAS and the World Ag Outlook Board does the same thing for the WASDE report, which, of course, is released simultaneously with the crop production report when we do that. But you know, we've wanted to expand that audience for a long time, and we finally have an opportunity to do that. So when we do these briefings for the secretary, or as you said, whoever happens to be signing that day, we're actually going to live stream it on YouTube. And so it'll be readily available to everyone as it's happening. The current plan is to, well, of course, it depends on the release time, but for the crop-related releases that come out at noon Eastern time, that briefing will start at about 12:05 Eastern time. So just 5 minutes after the report is released, we'll be providing that briefing live and available for everyone to see. It's just another way to increase our transparency and make as much information available to everyone as possible.
And does that mean that briefing is moved in time? So did it occur in lockup previously and now it will not?
So historically, we used to start the briefing shortly before 12. We would bring the secretary into the lockup space and start that process of briefing him or her before the release actually occurred. But for a while now, we've actually pushed that to just after lockup. It had no bearing on the release itself or what was happening. And so logistically, it just became easier to move that process shortly after the release. And that also allowed us to more adequately prepare for the launch of this live stream. And so, yeah, you're right that back in time, it used to occur a little bit earlier, but really only about 10 or 15 minutes earlier.
And those who want to watch it can find it where?
It'll be live streamed on the NASS YouTube channel. And there's certainly information. Well, anybody with Google can probably find the NASS YouTube channel. But also if you go to nass.usda.gov, you'll find some information there to link you straight to it.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Really appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. That's Lance Honig. He is the chief of the crops branch at USDA NASS. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Usually on Thursdays, we talk about the weather forecast with Mike Tenor at tstorm.net. He's not available today. Let me take you through some of the growing regions across the planet. We'll start in Iowa, where over the next week, they'll be in the mid-50s to low 60s. For the highs, they have a chance of rainfall, and their lows will be in the 30s over the weekend, but pop up to the 40s and even the 50s by the time we get to early next week. There is some snowfall in the offing for Iowa, by the way. Potentially on Wednesday in Illinois, a bit warmer. Highs 74 today and then dropping down to 59, 54, 64 and sunny on Sunday. 68 on Monday under cloudy skies. Rainfall and in the 50s for the rest of the week through Thursday next week. Nebraska, which is the number three corn producing state in the nation, should be in the mid-50s through the weekend. And then on Saturday and Sunday, things begin to heat up a little bit, actually. And they stay warm right through Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week, and then they cool off again. Rainfall there as well in part of the week. The 40s for today and tomorrow in Minnesota, Saturday and Sunday in the mid-50s for the high, sunshine, partly cloudy skies there. And we'll turn our attention to South America as well, where Mato Grosso in Brazil is 85 and heating up yet today. They'll go to 87 on Friday, 90 on Saturday, Sunday 86. And all week long, all the way through Thursday, actually, they have rainfall lows in the 70s, by the way, in Mato Grosso. In Rondônia, Brazil, in the mid-80s for the week, rainfall all week, low 70s for the overnight lows. And Mato Grosso do Sul, which is in the southern part of Brazil, in the mid-90s for a good portion of the week. Some rainfall on and off. They do have some cooler temperatures in the evening down into the upper 60s, low 70s for their overnight lows. And we'll take one other quick look in Kyiv, Ukraine this week. 36, 38, 41, 43 through Sunday as their highs, then 51, 54, 58, and 58 through Thursday. The overnight lows all stay below freezing all week long through Thursday in Kyiv, Ukraine. That's a quick look at some of the weather forecast across the growing regions of the planet. You've been listening, of course, to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online, listen to us on demand anytime you'd like.